This is John McMurray of the Society for American Baseball Research, and I am speaking today with Buddy Bell for an oral history of his time in professional baseball. A six-time Gold Glove winner and a five-time All-Star, Buddy played for 18 seasons in the major leagues and is best known for his years playing third base for the Texas Rangers and the Cleveland Indians. He also was a major league manager during nine seasons and has continued in the sport as an executive during a career in baseball which has spanned the last half century. We are recording this interview with Buddy's permission on December the 21st, 2023. And Buddy, you're the son of Gus Bell, who achieved success as an outfielder for the Cincinnati Redlegs and later the Reds in the 50s and 60s. What influence did growing up as the son of a major leaguer have on developing your own interest in baseball?
He had a lot to do with it, John. It wasn't, it wasn't much physical stuff he helped me with, because he just kind of let me go, let the coaches that I had in amateur baseball sort of take over and kind of teach me. And also he just really encouraged me to go out and play on my own, you know, whether that was throwing a ball up against the wall in the house. It didn't make my mother very happy, but he was so in touch with the mental part of the game and just the mental part of living in general. That he helped me in so many ways and you know, really worked with me with the process, you know, really try to keep me in the moment, which, you know, when I was younger, I didn't really understand it. As I got older, I, you know, really understood what he was talking about. And it, you know, I was a much better, student, for him, because he started at me at a younger age, so it got better as I went along. And there were still times when, you know, through the course of a game that I got ahead of myself. But for the most part, you know, I was able pretty much to stay in the moment. And I think that more than anything else, aside from the physical talent that God gave me, I think that's why I was able to have some success in this game.
I had read that your dad once said that he did a little to help you at the beginning, but he didn't do much after that. And that there were people such as Tim Rose, your coach in high school, who may have done more actually to help you than he did.
Tim Rose. Wow. That's, you know, actually Tim Rose is still coaching football at 82 years old. I think Tim is at Ashland College in Ohio and south of you guys. Tim, you know, one of the things that I think my dad did, he really, you know, gave the coaches that I have, because I think when you're growing up and you have a player whose father played as long as my dad did, there was probably some intimidation factor, maybe just because they might think they know too much or whatever. But, you know, dad, you know, let all my coaches pretty much, you know, if I had said anything, you know, halfway bad about a coach, that would be the last conversation I have with my dad on that day, because he just kind of let it go. He just made sure that I, you know, I respected that. And there were some coaches along the way that I didn't like. I just didn't think the players were the most important thing to them. So I had problems with that, but not very many. And the amateur coaches I had were all really, really good. Really good. I had, you know, Mike Cameron in baseball at Moeller High School. I think I'm not sure exactly how many state championships they won. Then I had Jerry Derger as a basketball coach. Tim Rose was very instrumental in just about everything that did. I'll tell you a funny story about Tim Rose. He was a head football coach at Lorain, it's like the Catholic school there in Lorain. I can't remember exactly what the name of the school was, but I would get him tickets to come down to the Memorial Stadium down on the lake, and he would come quite a bit. There was this one night I hit a ball down the left field line, and the wind was blowing like crazy. The wind blew the ball back fair, and I was standing at home plate. First of all, that's probably the most I never did it after that, but it was embarrassing, and you know. I think Frank Robinson might have been the manager at the time. He didn't even say anything to me because he knew I just screwed up. He, you know, or I was already embarrassed enough. But I walked out to my car after the game, and Tim was standing there, and he goes, "You were never taught that when you were at Mulder." You know, I'm like 24 and played on an all-star game. But, you know, those are the kind of guys that I think my dad really really let me learn from, and I'm really grateful for that.
Now, you were born in Pittsburgh, but also spent your formative years in Cincinnati at Archbishop Mohler. You know, you were really the first star there. Later on, Barry Larkin, Ken Griffey Jr. would come through. But what was it like playing baseball at Mohler?
Well, again, I mean, we had a meeting a couple months ago with a group of guys. And, you know, one of the experiments was that, you know, guys were talking about their life and the good and the bad. And, you know, everybody has stuff in their life, you know, whether you lose a close relative or something happens in your work or whatever. And somebody asked me what, you know, what's the worst thing that's ever, you know, and I honestly, other than those type things that everybody has to go through, my life has been exceptional. I mean, I've been so lucky with my family, with my kids. I mean, everything's been great. So, you know, going to Mohler was probably the first time I ever really started to kind of figure things out. And, you know, it's such a competitive school and still is, that I think it drove me to be. I don't think if I would have gone there, I would have been as competitive as I am or I was. I mean, I'm 72 now, so I'm still a little bit competitive, but not as able to be as competitive. But it was great. I had great teammates, and still, of all the guys that I hang around with now, those guys are the guys I talk to the most still. And that was over 50 years ago. So so I've been really blessed, John. I've been, you know, I can't look back, and I don't have any regrets about just about anything. Of course, certainly you have small regrets and things like that, things you would have done differently. But going to Mohler, my kids, my David went there, Michael went there, Ricky went there. I got a couple grandkids going there now. So kind of the kind of legend lives on, I guess.
Now, you played both basketball and baseball in high school. Which one were you better at the time?
Well, I was better in baseball, but I love basketball. I mean, I love baseball, but basketball doesn't. I mean, basketball is, I you know, I wish I could, you know, I was a little quicker. I could jump a little better. I could shoot a little better, but I love basketball. As a matter of fact, I coached high school basketball in the winter because I loved it so much. I mean, I love working with the kids. I just like being around. I like the intensity of it. You can't hide, you know, if you're, you know, half stepping it out there, that somebody's going to see you, not going to play. But I just like the competitive part of it. I like the closeness of it too. I like the people close to you. In baseball, you've got a little bit of that. But in basketball, everything's right on top of you. You're sweating and you're getting after it. And so I wish I could have been a better basketball player. I was all right. I wasn't, you know, the things these kids do now on the basketball floor is incredible to me. And I have a grandson that plays at Mohler. He's a junior. And seeing these guys, seeing what they do now compared to what we used to do is, it's not even close, you know, the athleticism. So I love watching it. I watch college basketball every night. I'm just obsessed with it. But baseball was more, I don't know. I think baseball was, you know, I found myself in kind of a no-win situation sometimes because of who my dad was. And people expecting you to do this and do that. And I was always uncomfortable with that. I just didn't, I don't know. I hate to do something where you don't get any recognition for it. Not that, you know, pushes me every day. I don't need it necessarily, but at the same time, I think it's helpful. I think it's good for your self-esteem. It's good for your, you know, your soul, good for your heart, good for everything. So, in baseball, there were times where I just said, you know what, I'm not getting anything out of this. And basketball was a little bit different. But as things turned, then I started getting a little bit stronger. Because when I was a freshman in high school, I was like 5'4", 115 pounds. I mean, I was small. But when I got out of, when I was a senior in high school, or when I graduated, I was 6'1", about one. Well, I left Sarasota my first year in baseball at 145. So I was a small dude. And then all of a sudden I just started growing. You know, I'm 230 now. So, but anyway, all of a sudden when I got into pro ball, it wasn't until pro ball where I really loved baseball, because people didn't really care anymore. They didn't care who I was. They just, you know, I was in my element more or less. And I wish I would have had that when I was younger, so I could have a little bit more fun with it. It wasn't great fun for me, baseball, but basketball was. I played a little football, but you know, Jerry Faust was at Mueller then, and Jerry's a good friend. And he used to hammer me all the time for not playing football after my sophomore year, but I just don't have time to do it.
Now, after you graduated, you're selected by the Cleveland Indians in the 16th round of the June free agent draft in June 1969. How did you feel going to Cleveland?
Well, I felt good. I wasn't sure what was happening because you hear so many different things. We were in Columbus. We had an East-West All-Star game they used to have for the high schoolers in the state of Ohio. As a matter of fact, on that team, Wally Post's grandson was on that team. And John and I had been friends while Dad and Wally were playing together in Cincinnati. So that was kind of cool. But that was the same week as the draft. And I had heard anywhere from the first round to the fifth round that I was going to go. And as it turned out, the first day went by. You know, halfway through the second day, that went by, and finally I got taken in the 16th round, which at that time I didn't even know the difference, quite frankly. You know, the bonuses weren't that different. You know, I got $5,000 and a college scholarship, which helped, but I just wanted to play ball. I just wanted to go. So going to Cleveland was awesome. I mean, I'm retired now, and every time I get fired from a job, whether it's been actually fired a couple times from a manager job, and I always go back to Cleveland for some reason. I love the people in Cleveland. I love the front office people. I get tons of friends up there. So if I ever want to come back, I would probably only go back to Cleveland to finish my career there. So I absolutely love Cleveland. I love the city. I love the way that people are. And there's just really not a whole lot about Cleveland I didn't like, even though, you know, we really struggled. I mean, we had no money. The movie Major League was pretty spot on, to be honest with you. But we didn't know any better. We didn't. Shoot, I thought Municipal Stadium was the greatest place in the world. It was like Wally World, you know. And all my friends, you know, I was really lucky, you know, growing up in that system, because I had, you know, Gaylord Perry, Ray Fosse, Greg Nettles, Eddie Leone. I mean, I had so, Jerry Moses, people, I mean, I don't know, a lot of those guys, people will remember, some of them they won't, but it was just such a learning experience for me, and they were all so good to me. You know, I would get razzed every once in a while just because I was young. I was 20, I think. You know, now, you know, I have lifelong Rick Manning, Dwayne Kuiper, Eckersley. I mean, all these guys, we still to this day stay in touch, and we're really close. So the Cleveland's always was sort of the place that I always sort of latched on to.
Of course, Gabe Paul and Phil Segey were in the Cleveland front office at that time. They knew your dad back in Cincinnati. Do you think that's a reason why Cleveland picked you?
I don't know. It might be. You know, I never asked, you know, when Gabe was living or when Phil was living, I never asked him that. I think part of it was just being in Ohio. I think it's probably easier to see us play or whatever. But, you know, I'm glad they did. You know, the scout that drafted me ended up being a good friend of mine too, Joe Moreland's. I don't know. There's just the opportunity was there, and I took advantage of it. It's weird because, you know, when I started, I was still small, and you know, I went down to Florida, and, you know, running these guys that are 6'3", 220. I mean, I was like, man, I have no. We had my first manager was Joe Lutz. He was an old Marine drill sergeant, and pretty much managed that way as well. But he told us the first day, he goes, you know, he goes, there's only one player out of 500 players that are drafted that ever get a chance to just be in the big leagues, not play in the big, but have a chance to play in the big leagues. I'm sitting there, and there's like 40 or 50 of us, and I'm like, oh, that guy's much better than he's good, you know. So I figured I had no chance, but it also gave me some, you know, some incentive to push myself. And quite frankly, what happened to me was I just got stronger. I just, you know, I hit a growth spurt and I just got stronger. And all the things that I was able to do as a weaker player, I was able to do as a stronger player, which really, really helped.
Now, you spent 3 years in Cleveland's farm system. Your 1971 season in Wichita was a particularly strong one. You were the rookie of the year there, the MVP of the team in Wichita. And that led to you in coming up in 1972 to spring training with Cleveland. Did you have some thoughts that you might be able to make the team?
No, I don't think I didn't think I had any chance. As a matter of fact, our manager, Kenneth Spermonti, told me I was not going to make the team. And the reason I wasn't going to make the team, I think it was more of a numbers issue than anything else. I mean, obviously I wasn't the kind of player that I was later on in my career. You know, as a rookie, there's a lot of mistakes and things like that. But I think it was more of a numbers issue as far as me not having a chance to make the club. But what happened was the guys started getting hurt like crazy. As a matter of fact, the major league the club went to Huma and didn't take me. There was like three of us that they left behind because back in those days in Cleveland, they didn't want to spend any money on the hotel if you weren't going to play. I mean, you just didn't go. I mean, if you weren't going to play, they didn't want to pay for the hotel. So they kept me and a couple other guys back in Tucson. There was a couple guys that got hurt the day before. So they called me like 4 a.m. and said, you have got to get to Yuma, Arizona today because we need you to play. And I played 2 games that day. I got there. I left Tucson probably about 5 a.m, got there at 8:30, something like that. We had a B game at 10. I went 5 for 5 in the B game. And during the B game, one of the other outfielders got hurt. So I asked Ramani, he said, can you play the outfield? And I said, I play all the time. I've never played an inning in the outfield ever. But I told Ramani, I said, yeah, I'm really good out there. like, oh, keep my fingers crossed. And that, so I played in the B game, went 5 for 5. In the A game, I went 3 for 4 with a home run and played the outfield. And we went from there, we went from Yuma to Scottsdale to play the Cubs. And I went 4 for 5 the next day. So then I sort of made it hard for him to, you know, to at least send me out. So they had to keep playing me because they had nobody else to play. And I started working the outfield, and opening day I opened up in right field against the Brewers after the strike, you know, because we had the strike that. You know, we were barnstorming from Tucson to Cleveland. And so I think we, I think it was maybe a week or two. I think it was 2 weeks that we were out before opening day. I think opening day was around the 15th or something like that. I'm not sure.
And you had played third base in the minors along with some second base. But of course, Cleveland had Greg Nettles at third base. So that was blocked for you. So that had to make you wonder what your future was in Cleveland at that time.
Yeah, again, John, I didn't really think about it much. I just thought about being in the lineup somehow. Even up to this day, I didn't really care where I played. You know, later on in my, like, I think it was 2 or 3 years later, you know, I had become a decent third baseman. I still wasn't as good as I needed to be, but I was all right. But they signed Bill Melton over the winter and moved me to left field. And Melton couldn't play the outfield. So I went to Robbie one day. I said, listen, Melton can't play the outfield. I can play the outfield. So I started out there. I didn't really care where I played. Kind of like the outfield. You could kind of not think about much other than hitting out there. I thought that was kind of cool. But but I don't know. The move never really... But even to this day, you know, when I was managing, when we wanted to a player to make a position change, the one thing that always irritated me more than anything was a player balking at changing a position. It's not that he was going to play, he was going to be in the lineup, but he needed to play another position because we needed to, you know, to make this work. And that... probably among a couple other things, probably irritate me more today than ever about today's player, that they don't have the, I don't know, I don't think it's a confidence factor. I think it's more of a selfish factor. I'm not thrilled with that.
Now, in Cleveland, you mentioned about some difficult times, but there also was a fair amount of talent on those early Cleveland teams. I wondered if you could, you mentioned Ray Fosse earlier. I wondered if you could tell us a little about what it was like seeing him at that stage of his career.
Oh, he was awesome. Unfortunately, you know, Ray passed away last year, and he was one of my closest, dearest friends up to the day he died. He was just one of these guys that's tough, no excuses. You know, always had his eyes and ears open for somebody that in the clubhouse that was having a bad day, you know, whether it was at the ballpark or whether it was at home. Because, you know, all of us have home lives. And, you know, everything isn't 100% great all the time. So you have to leave, you know, a situation like that, go to the ballpark and play ball. It's not always that easy. So we had guys like Ray and Nettles and guys like that, Jerry Moses, that you know, helped me along the way grow up, you know, because as a youngster, you know, it's a lot easier to make excuses, and they wouldn't allow that. So, but I had, you know, looking back on I know why we didn't win. We just didn't have a ton of depth. We didn't have a ton of pitching either, which is not easy to win in, you know, in any baseball league if you don't have pitching. But we had, you know, I played Boo Powell. Gaylord was there. I mean, we didn't have, now that I look at it, now I think about it, we didn't have a ton of talent. But the younger guys like Manning and Kuiper, George Hendrick was a great, great player that people, don't really, because of the way George was. You know, George was kind of standoffish, but he was a great player. But we had, I wouldn't trade any of the years in Cleveland I had for anything. I mean, even though we didn't win, the friendships and the blessings that I got, playing there was just extraordinary, and I would never change it for anything.
Well, in 1973, you transitioned back to third base. You also made your first All-Star game appearance in Kansas City in the bottom of the third inning. You came to bat against Claude Osteen. What do you remember about that at bat?
Well, first of all, Claude Osteen grew up in Cincinnati, so I was well aware of Claude. And as a matter of fact, Claude played with my father in Cincinnati. I don't know if it was in the minor leagues or the major leagues, but Claude was in the Reds organization at one time. So I was well aware of Claude. And that was my first thought. You know, I can't remember who I hit for. Might have been for the pitcher. I think Dick Williams was the manager, but anyway,
you were pinch hitting for Blylevin.
Was it?
Yep.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. So, but anyway, my initial shot was, I'm going to hit against Claude Osteen, but I was shook. You know, I mean, I was nervous, I was anxious, and this is really the first time I think in my career where, in my eyes, the whole world was looking at you. You know, they weren't, but in my eyes, that's the environment and everything was electric. But I hit the triple. As soon as I hit it, I knew it was a hit. But it got by him somehow. And at that particular time in my career, I could run a little bit. But I remember getting to third, and I forgot to tape my socks, so my socks were all down in my shoes, and I had dirt all over. And I forget who the third base coach was, but it was a great evening. My family was watching, and it was really. I made a few other All-Star games, and that was by far the most the best All-Star game I played in.
Now, over your time in Cleveland, you were a model of consistency. You had a similar number of home runs from year to year. You also were driving in a similar number of runs and developing into a preeminent third baseman. What was the secret to being consistent year to year?
That's a good question, John. I don't even know if I can remember. I think I owe a lot of it to, to the players that I played with early on in my career, that they made sure that I was doing my work, that I didn't take anything for granted, that I understood how, being what a good teammate was. I mean, there's just so many intangibles that I think they're important. And being successful, and I don't think I really would have been able to deal with those intangibles if I didn't have these guys pushing me. I had really good managers. I had managers I liked. I had managers I didn't like. But Don Zimmer was great. Ken Aspromonte was great to me. Jeff Torborg was a manager in Cleveland who I loved. He was a great friend. So I had good managers, but I didn't really learn a lot from managers. The managers, and that's one of the things I didn't like about managing, is you really couldn't get into the the nitty gritty of teaching a guy how to play ball. That was all. You kind of leaped it. I mean, you got involved, but you didn't get involved as if you were a positional coach. And I like the positional coach better than I did being a manager. But you just don't make the kind of money, you know. And, you know, when you have five kids, money's important, right? So, and I thought I would be okay as a manager as well. But I learned, but I worked hard. I mean, I got after it. I mean, it was really, really, really important to me and how I did every night. I wish, looking back on my career, I wish I would have been able to, you know, leave the game at the ballpark more than I did. Not that I was, didn't talk to my family or didn't want to be around them. I just wish that it didn't bother me as much, you know, and I think I think if I could have done some things differently, mentally, I probably would have been a Hall of Fame player, you know, at this point. But again, I don't have any regrets. I mean, I did as much as I could do, you know, within what my abilities to handle things.
Well, those Cleveland teams struggled a lot. To what degree did the losing wear on you?
A ton. And again, the people around you just made it easier, I think. You know, I said before, I would never change any of it for anything. And I wouldn't. I just wish we would have won a little more, you know. And a lot of it, unfortunately, was the, quite honestly, frankly, it was, you know, our organizations weren't the best. You know, there was always confusion about who owned the team, and you know, we'd go into cities and we couldn't stay at this hotel because we didn't pay for the bill the last time we were in town. And I mean, it was just like a crazy stuff. I mean, even the plane that we took. There was a scene in Major League, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was pretty much the same kind of plane that we were in, you know, because I think we were in Chicago, and they couldn't take all our bags with us, so they had to have a chaser plane. We traveled in, and I can't remember, I think it was a DC-9 maybe. Kind of like a small propeller job. They couldn't fit all our stuff in it, so they had to have another plane follow us. So we went to Chicago, and we got to the plane, and there was something wrong with the plane. So they had to fly back to Cleveland, get another. Oh, they had a tire. It was a tire they didn't have. So we sat on a tarmac for like 4 hours. You know, so the plane could go back to Cleveland, get the time. So, I mean, it was like crazy stuff like that. But you know what? It made us all closer. It gave us, you know, something to bitch about every day. but it was just kind of, I don't know, I said it earlier. It just sort of what I thought it was all about. I didn't really have any kind of anything else to compare it to, really. You know, I'm glad at that time I didn't. Some of the older guys that we had come over were miserable. So we kind of, we weeded them out a little bit. And then, you know, if we could have just kept that group together, and then they had to, you know, sell some of our guys to meet payroll and things like that. And it just didn't make for a very well-organized, you know, situation. But, you know, we made it, we all made it.
Now in 1978, you wind up being traded to the Texas Rangers. What do you think was the reason for the trade, and how did you feel going from Cleveland to Texas?
Well, that was a weird time. I mean, first of all, what happened in Cleveland, I had agreed to a contract in the spring of 78. My last year in Cleveland, and I agreed to a contract verbally with the organization, and something happened over the course of time where they decided they didn't want to do the contract. I was livid, and because everything was fine, I had never had any problems with this at all. And it's just another indication of how things were done in Cleveland, where they weren't sure if they were going to have enough money to do anything. So they just agreed with me. And I would have, at the end of the day, I was just going to say, okay, no problem. Well, I didn't do it this time. And I was in a meeting with Gabe and Phil, and I got pretty upset. And our relationship was not very good after that. Since then, before Gabe and Phil, I had obviously talked to them. Everything was fine after that. But at that particular time, looking back on it, Phil and Gabe really didn't have anything to do with it. It's not their money. But just the fact that it was agreed upon and it fell through, it was just kind of typical on things that I had, or we as a team had been dealing with the 6 years previous to that. So my relationship with them was kind of was bad the whole year. So the trade didn't surprise me. And it actually turned out, it actually turned out well, because the years I had in Texas were awesome. Again, I still don't feel the same about Texas as I do Cleveland, but it's pretty close. And I got traded for one of my dearest friends ever, Toby Hara, who became a coach for me in Detroit and in Colorado. So it all worked out. Toby, again, is one of my dearest, closest friends. And, I had known Toby before we got traded, and I knew him obviously while we were playing against each other, but we became really, really close after I went back to Texas, and he was a player there. So it worked out for everybody.
You could argue that your 1979 season was your best. The first season in Texas, you played in every game. You led the American League in at-bats. What was different that season?
I don't know. I think the team was better than I had played with in Cleveland. That always makes it easier when you have better players around you. Al Oliver, Bump Wills, Jim Sundberg, myself. We had, we had some pretty good players.
Fergie Jenkins.
Fergie was there. That's right. Yeah. So I don't know. I just think it was better. I think it was a change of scenery as well. Maybe got my juices started a little bit. Where in Cleveland, it was sort of the same all the time, maybe. But Texas, I think it was just more of a change of scenery. I really do. And I started to get some recognition that I didn't get in Cleveland, maybe, just because of the year that I was having. And the years in Texas were very, very similar to the years I had in Cleveland, except the numbers were a little bit different. I think the reason the numbers were different was just there's more guys on base. There's more opportunity, So I don't think I was that much better. I just started. I think I went to a place where I didn't think I could ever go as far as a player. So my confidence was much higher than I believe when that first year I had in Texas.
And you also started your run of six consecutive gold gloves from 79 through 84. Certainly in the 1970s, Brooks Robinson and Greg Nettles and yourself were the preeminent fielding third baseman. I've read that you worked with Greg Nettles and that he taught you to play a little more off the line in order to, because more balls were hit into the hole as opposed to down the line. And is that accurate? And did it make that much of a difference?
Made a big difference. What he used to tell me was, you know, guys that played the line were just trying to stay away from the ball. And that for me is right. I think that's the way most guys are. They use the line as a somewhat of a security blanket, you know, that they don't have to go to the right. Yeah, Puff is his nickname. Nettles helped me a lot. He helped me with that. He also, I used to play a little too shallow. And he said, listen, if the guy's going to bunt, he's going to bunt. You can't throw him out anyway. So if the guy does bunt, take the bunt away from him. If he doesn't, just go back. Don't worry about him, you know. So he was really, really good. As a matter of fact, he only helped me when he went to the Yankees, because he was playing third in Cleveland. I was in the outfield. So we didn't really talk about playing third much. It was only until he went to the Yankees and we were playing against each other is when he would give me these little hints of advice. And, you know, I was really grateful for that.
You mentioned that you work very hard at your defense, but what does someone have to do to become a better defensive third baseman?
Well, aside from work and the heart, you know, the never really taking a day off. Other than that, I think a lot of it is athletic. I mean, I think you have to be athletic to play third. I think just because the ball gets on you so quick, and because of the one hoppers you get and things like that. I think you have to be really athletic. I think you have to work on your agility. You know, I just don't think taking ground balls is going to do it. I think you have to also work on your athleticism, your strength and conditioning and things like that too. But also, I think the biggest problem third basemen have, the guys that can't play third, is fear. I think that's why you see a lot of shortstops who go from shortstop to third base struggle, because the ball gets on you and they fear the hop. You know, it just gets on you so much quicker than it does at short. At short, you can kind of rearrange your feet, you can kind of fix yourself. At 30, you can't do that. So there's a lot of athleticism involved in playing third, and the actual fear of getting hit with a ball, it has to be non-existent. You can't worry about that, you know.
In Texas, those teams had a lot of talent, but you also had some quality competition. The Angels, the White Sox, the Royals, the A's were all winning division titles. Were at a time when not a lot of teams were making the postseason. What was the reason, do you think, that the Texas teams never quite got over the hump?
John, I'm telling you, man, it's the same thing that happened in Cleveland. It was the confusion about ownership and who's running the team and, you know, managerial changes and GM changes. I mean, it was just something all the time. And it was always money and financially driven. You know, it's always that was always the issue. You know, we couldn't hang on to players. You know, guys that started having good years and, you know, we'd have to trade them. You know, my situation in Texas, I always tell people this. I was always the best player in Texas, but that's not good. I mean, I was a good player, but I can't – to win a championship, I can't be the best player. I just – you know, you have to have more impact. And again, I belong in the lineup, but I shouldn't be hitting third or fourth. I don't think. Looking back on my career, that's the way I look at it, and that's the reason why I don't think we won, because we just never had those two impact guys that could come up in the eighth or ninth and hit you a home run, hit you a three-run homer. I was not a home run hitter. So those are, you know, there was a lot of reasons for it. again, I wouldn't change any of those years for anything. I just wish that the outcome would have been different.
And so you wind up going to Cincinnati, and you played under Pete Rose, and you also had some pretty prominent players like Dave Parker who were around. Was it a different dynamic there?
Yeah, it was great going back home. It was one of the highlights of my career, going home for, I think I played there for closer to 4 years. But going back to Cincinnati was great. Texas, at that time, they were going to rebuild. I was on the last year of my contract, I think. And they did, you know, Eddie Childs, who was a friend of mine, was the owner of the club, did me a favor by trading me to Cincinnati, which I was good to Texas. And, you know, I was awesome there. I was loyal to them. You know, my years in Texas were awesome. So they really, they did a nice thing and let me go back to Cincinnati, because that's what I wanted to do to end my career. And I had the years I had in Cincinnati were awesome as well. I mean, I played with some great players. I still have great friends that I played with there. And that was a little bit different than some of the other places. I thought, I'm not sure what our records were there, but we had some pretty good teams. We were up against LA all the time. We were up against the Giants. I think Houston was in our league at that particular time. So we had some pretty stiff competition. But again, we didn't have enough pitching. But a little, you know, a couple breaks here and there, we could have gotten. Well, at that time they didn't have the playoffs. You know, it was just strictly you're in, and you know, you play one round and then you go to the World Series. I think that's the way it was. But yeah, Cincinnati was fine. It was great. It was a good move. Sometimes going back home isn't the easiest. And my son David, managing in Cincinnati now, and he's from Cincinnati. So I know it's tough for him at times, just because of the expectations and things like that. But it's just part of being a manager anyway. But it worked out really well.
What was Pete Rose like as a manager?
He is awesome. I just feel so bad for him. Obviously he's a Hall of Fame player with Hall of Fame credentials. But he's the smartest baseball guy I've ever been around. I mean, he didn't miss anything. Like nothing. He's a great teammate. I think what happened with Pete, but when he was done playing, I just don't think managing, and it just wasn't enough. He loved playing so much. And I think he liked being a manager, but it wasn't the same. And I just think he just, you know, I don't, it's just a shame that more people can't learn from him. You know, that's something he was really good at. It's just a shame that it's kind of ended up like this. I hope he gets in the Hall of Fame at some point. I think he's paid his penalty, and I think we all should move on.
Did you have any sense that anything was afoot when you were playing under him?
Not really, John. I didn't really pay a lot of attention to it. I mean, there was some talk. You know, never about the gambling. It's about the you know, the guys that he was hanging around with, I think, more than anything. We were so caught up in our own careers and things like that. We didn't know it was that serious, you know. And obviously, you know, I don't know. It's just, every time I think about it, it just kind of makes me sick. You know,
I wanted to ask you about getting, you wind up in Houston, being traded for a player to be named later. Not a lot of people remember it because it's only part of one season after your time in Cincinnati. What do you recall about your time with the Houston Astros? Of course, going back to Texas.
Again, you know, when we first started this conversation, John, I told you I'd really been blessed, and there's I don't have a lot of regrets. And Houston, going to Houston was another a good experience for me. We had a really good team then. It was probably the best team that I had played with as far as chemistry and just, you know, all the kind of pieces in place. You had Nolan, you had Mike Scott, Billy Doran, Craig Reynolds, myself, Glenn Davis, Alan Ashby. I mean, and then our pitching staff was really good. You know, again, though, I got hurt the last month of the season, I think. I think I ended up playing, but I didn't. I can hardly even walk with my knees. And I think a few other guys got hurt. We just kind of fell behind the last month of the season. But it was, again, it was a situation where it was a good one for me. I was actually going to go back to Houston. And that winter, I was going to sign a 2-year deal. And this was right around the collusion stuff that was going on. I was going to sign a 2-year deal, and they were going to give me the same money for both years. You know, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I don't, you know, why would I do that? You know. So in the meantime, Texas had called me and wanted to know if I would go back there. They had a young third baseman there, Steve Buchel, and a couple other players that they'd like for me to be a part of their team and sort of help out. I knew I wasn't going to play every day. I just physically, I wasn't capable of doing that anymore. But Texas had called me and asked me if I'd be interested. And that's what I did. I went back there on a 1-year deal and I made it till June. I didn't play a whole lot. I wish I wouldn't have done that. I guess that's one of the things that maybe I do regret a little bit, is going back to Texas. It always seems like you can't go back twice. I don't know. But things just didn't work out the way. So I retired in June of that year. I think it was June. And I get in the rest of my career after that.
And you did get to play with Nolan Ryan in Texas for a period of time. What was that like?
It was great. He's also a good friend and unique dude, man. I mean, he was still doing it at 45 years old. I mean, they talk about Tom Brady quarterbacking. I mean, and that's awesome. I mean, that's an incredible feat, but you're talking about a 45-year-old man throwing 140, 150 pitches every 5 days. That's pretty incredible, you know, and people tend to, you know, forget, not only they know Nolan's a great pitcher, but he did it for so long and without, you know, a ton of injuries. Man, he pitched hurt a ton. So it wasn't somebody that went out there and was healthy every night, but he was probably the most unique dude I've ever played with, just because of how strong and how athletic he was. I mean, he was just and he's a smart guy too. He's really good to talk to and, you know, kind of laid back, but tough all at the same time. A great teammate. Fergie Jenkins, another great, great, great teammate. You had mentioned him before. So we I was able to play with a lot of really good people.
You managed for 9 seasons, the Tigers, the Rockies, and the Royals. In 1997, you were second in the Manager of the Year voting, and you led the Tigers to a 26-game improvement from the year prior. Of all your managerial experiences, which one do you remember the most fondly?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think I remember any of them fondly. Managing was weird for me, John. I liked it from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock. I didn't like the other times, you know, dealing with the media or, you know, dealing with problems. I mean, you could never really get on the field and do what you wanted to do. I always felt like I could never get on the field to to have any the kind of impact that I thought I was going to have as a manager. And you just you just don't have the time. And you know, it was hard, quite honestly, to making the kind of money you do as a manager as opposed to a coach is not even close. It's ridiculous. It's sad, actually. But because of that, I just said, you know, I'm doing all right here. I'm not going to change it up right now. So, and that's why I eventually got back into player development, because that's my passion, really. That's I could have managed a couple more years and a couple more times, but I just didn't feel like that was what I wanted to do. But I liked it, but I for sure couldn't do it today. There's no way.
Mentioned how much you enjoyed being an instructor, that working, let's say, is with a third baseman or something like that would allow you to get a little deeper than you would be able to as a manager.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and I, you know, for me, you know, I'm a lot like my dad. I think the mental approach to the game is just so important. You know, this you try not to let the game define you, but it does. It just takes its toll on you sometimes, you know, just because it just becomes so important. And so you try to, you know, my dad always said, please don't let this define you. So those are the kind of things that I think I'm probably better at than the actual, you know, put your foot over here, put your heel over here, put your elbow up here, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I can do that. I can pick it out, but it's not that's something you do just kind of automatically. When the mental approach to the game, you have to actually think about it. You just really have the courage to do what you think is right.
Well, in 2005, you co-wrote a book, "Smart Baseball: How Professionals Play the Mental Game," and talking about preparation, and that sometimes the mental approach is really what makes the difference in whether players succeed or fail. Tell us more about what you're getting at with that book.
Yeah, I had a guy come up. It was his Neil.
Neil Bailey.
Yeah. Actually, my son came to me one day. He said, "You know, this guy, he was talking to me about a book. You know, about, you know, maybe you guys can get involved with, you know, your experiences and things like that." And I spent probably 3 or 4 months with Neil. He would come down spring training, and he'd meet me during the season and things like that. And we discussed this. And it came out fine. I mean, it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. I don't think it was as organized as I wanted it at the end of the day. But again, this is such an important part of who I am, as far as, you know, the mental approach to the game and how you would just watch the game. So many of our young players now, they don't even know how to watch the game. You cannot believe how much better a player you will be if you just watch what the guy's doing. You know, where are they playing you? What are they throwing you? I mean, you can't figure that out if you're not watching the game. And it's amazing. If you look down as a manager, I used to look down, and it used to piss me off. Look down the in the dugout, and guys aren't even watching the game. They're spitting sunflower seeds, and they're not even paying attention. It used to drive me crazy. So those are the kind of things that were really important to me. What we put in the book are really important, and some of the experiences I had with some of the guys I played with, and some of the older guys that really taught a lot.
You also, as you mentioned about player development, your role with the Chicago White Sox allowed you to become involved with that. You worked for a decade with the White Sox. Tell us a little about that work.
Yeah, I love the White Sox. White Sox were a great organization. Their owner was awesome, Jerry Reinsdorf. I actually hired the GM who's there now, Chris Getz. He was an assistant for me, but it was a great 10 years. I wanted to go back to Cincinnati again because I had an idea my son might be going back there at some point, and I wanted a chance to work with him before my career was over, and I was able to do that. I retired last year in June. June must be my retirement month, but I retired. So I just kind of got, I just needed to do something different, you know, let him kind of do his own thing. And I enjoyed the years I had there, but I'm done. You know, I figured this is good for me. You know, I want to spend time with my grandkids and my wife and my kids. And this gives me the best chance to do that. I would love to be back in baseball, but my preference is hanging out with my family.
I have in front of me a questionnaire that you completed many years ago, early in your career. It's kept at the Giamatti Library at the Baseball Hall of Fame. And it asks you, what do you consider your outstanding achievement in baseball? And you write, my first home run was a grand slam. That's right. Do you still feel that way?
No. I think my highlight is seeing my sons, David and Michael, play in the big leagues. I don't think there's anything that's better than that. I mean, just from the sheer standpoint, how happy that made them. You know, David had a good career in 12 years in the big leagues. And then Mike, who unfortunately passed away 2 years ago, he played with the Reds for a few months. So the home run off Eddie Watt was huge. Don't get me wrong, but not as good as seeing my kids realize their dreams.
To a certain generation of baseball fans, they associate you very closely with those Cleveland teams and wearing those red fire engine uniforms. And sometimes when you talk about those teams, your name is the first one that comes up. What does it mean to you to have that deep association with a fan base from so long ago?
Well, it's really nice. I mean, as I talked about Cleveland earlier, and you know how I feel about them now. I think it's part of it was just kind of the teams that we had. We were the incidents we had, and we had guys swapping their wives. we had all kind of crazy stuff going on. And there wasn't many people in the stands. We very seldom ever had, more than a couple thousand people there. But they were there every night. They were true fans, and you could hear every single one of them because that stadium was so cavernous that you could hear everybody talking. You know, if they said anything bad about you, you could hear it. If you said anything good about you, they heard about it. I don't know. It was just that Cleveland is just extra special in my mind and will always be, I have a safe place in my heart for them. But I don't know. I just think that it's, we just weren't very good, but we played our asses off.
When people think of your life in professional baseball years from now, what would you most like them to remember?
I think just being a good teammate. Probably not much more than that.
And Buddy Bell, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today for our Sabre Oral History.